Okay.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hold on, don't have to read that.
Good evening. Welcome to Las Vegas and the Mob on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Denny Griffin, and for the next 45 minutes, I'll be your host. And I have a repeat guest tonight, backed by popular demand, because we ran out of time the last time he was on with me. And my guest is Tony Napoli, also known as Tony Knapp. He's the author of the book, My Father, My Don, A Son's Journey from Organized Crime to Sobriety. And Tony is the son of his dad was Jimmy Knapp, Jimmy Napoli, also known as Jimmy Knapp. And he was a made man with the Genovese family out of New York City. And at one point, he ran the largest illegal gambling operation in the country. And Tony, welcome back to Las Vegas and the Mob.
Good to be back again, Dennis. Wish I was out there with you.
Well, we got some decent weather today. We had a little cold spell yesterday. How's things in the big city?
Cold. Chilly, cold, then nice in part of the day, and then it gets cold again, yeah. I'm in Forest Hills, Queens.
Okay, we have, if anybody would like to call in with a question or comment for Tony, you can reach us at 646-478-0982. 646-478-0982. Tony, when we were talking last time, we talked a little bit about the so-called Iceman, Mr. Linsky, who claimed he killed in excess of 100 people in his book, and at various times denied and then took credit for killing Jimmy Hoffa. We talked about him, but we didn't get into the Jimmy Hoffa thing when we ran out of time and had to sign off. Do you have any theories or anything about what actually happened to Hoffa?
Well, yes, I can only give an opinion.
Sure.
Not a theory, not a formula, not what happened, not before, not after. I knew Jimmy personally at times when I was in Vegas back in the 50s. And again, in the 60s, especially when I was relocated from the Sands Hotel in 1967 to Caesar's Palace. And, of course, I was at Caesar's Palace a couple of times back and forth. And I'm aware of the fact that Jimmy Hoffa helped move some money, Teamster Trust Fund, into Caesar's Palace at that time. Of course, he also started serving his jail sentence in 1967 as well. He was fighting it for about 3 years since 1964, but he was finally sentenced. And, of course, as we know, Nixon gave him a pardon and got him out in 1971. So he only did about five. He didn't even do, maybe he did about 58 months, of his jail time. And then now Jimmy had a lot of favors to him, too, for the boys, because he helped build invest money from the Teamster Fund into Vegas casinos in the 60s when he took control of the Teamsters. And he made money for the Teamsters, that's true. However, when he got released from jail in 1971, he was out for quite a few years until he was among the missing in 1975. So for those particular years, he didn't raise any hell trying to say what the newspapers or others were saying. Transfer of money that he had to withdraw from his local bank in Detroit. And some say it was close to $1 million. And I question that with some of the boys in the social clubs. Now, I'm talking to you about practical experience and conversation from old timers that were in social clubs talking, and I was eavesdropping, or some spoke to me personally, and I gave my opinions at the social clubs in Brooklyn as well. I'm also talking to you about what I gathered in information and listening in the casinos back in 67 at Caesar's Palace when I was a floor boss there. Well, anyway, Tony Pro from New Jersey, a very strong Teamster man and one of the biggest Teamster locals in the nation. If I'm not mistaken, I believe it was over 4,000 members he had in his local. He did time with Jimmy Hoffa and went away with him. Excuse me for coughing. And went away with him, and they were co-defendants when Hoffa was in court back in 60, I believe it was before 67. Yeah, he fought his case for about a few years, went away in 67. Well, anyway, they were in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, where my father was, but my father didn't get there until 1982 or so. Now, Hoffa, there was supposed to have been a fist fight. Now, this is, again, from hearsay in social clubs from old-timers, but they usually have confirmed information better than an encyclopedia. And because Jimmy Hoffa accused Tony Pro, we called him Tony Pro, but his real name was Anthony Provenzano. Hoffa accused Tony Pro of bringing the mob into the union, into the Teamsters International Brotherhood of Teamsters. And there was an argument about that because, accordingly, that if a guy's a made guy, well, has a title, they usually don't talk in the open streets about it or in the jailhouse. And Hoffa mentioned something like that to Tony Pro, and Tony Pro threw something at him, a cup of coffee, whatever it was. And accordingly, Tony Pro, and then Hoffa said something to him, and Tony Pro had made a remark that still stands today. Whoever the street guys are today that outlived others, either of natural causes or otherwise, but they're real old-timers. Tony Pro's words, "I'll get even with you," because he denounced Tony Pro and said that Tony, he actually called him a gangster, not a mobster, a gangster. And that he brought all the heat onto the Teamsters with the Genovese family, which I'm very familiar with. Well, anyway, if anybody had, go to Motive, like you yourself, Denny, you've been a private eye and whatnot. Go to Motive, and I'm just practical experience in and out of court all my life. But go to Motive, and what is the motive? Well, whereas Tony Pro wanted to build a restaurant in Jersey City, an elaborate type one, cost quite a bit of money, and when he got out of jail, and Hoffa was out, he notified Hoffa about forwarding some Teamster money to build, because Hoffa could build you a coffee shop with Teamster money. The man traveled with cash. It wasn't unusual for him to carry $100,000 in an attaché, traveling from one state to another, because he needed cash, because he had to do a lot of payouts, meaning Hoffa. Mm-hmm. So Tony Pro resented that one, too. He got turned down because Hoffa, at the time, between the 3 years before he was among the missing, the time he got, he finally was released on a president's pardon. What was he doing? He was turning a lot of people down. He didn't want to bother with them. But there was no mention of Hoffa trying to run and take over the union again. No. That was a no-no because the president, Nixon, also stated that the deal was that he doesn't get back into union life. And before he got sentenced, the judge had stated that part of the sentence. And when you are released after 10 years, which he didn't do 10 years, he did it half the time, you're not to get back into union life. And what happened was when he was pardoned 5 years before his time was up, he was told that also. So he obeyed what he had to obey, and there was a lot of cash floating around. And as far as if he's in a giant stadium, as far as which, or it was he cremated by Sheehan, who Charlie Brandt wrote the book about, that Sheehan confessed to him in the jailhouse. Well, I have my doubts about that one, because Charlie Brandt is a former prosecutor, attorney general prosecutor from Maryland. And he knew Sheehan for quite a while, and for a couple of years before Sheehan finally opened up and said to Charlie Brandt, the author of his life story, "I Heard You Paint Houses," that he confessed to the Hoffa killing and said he shot him in the head in a room, in a private room in Detroit, and then he cremated him, and nobody's ever going to find the body. Well, anyway, I have my doubts about that story, because Sheehan had a daughter that he wanted to support and give money to, and he knew he was dying of cancer, and he knew that he would never get out of the jail. And as far as I'm concerned, a guy like Charlie Brandt, who's a prosecutor, was leading him into confessing to that one, too, to make his story more spectacular in his book. Because I know Charlie Brandt personally, and he tried to get almost became the author of the writer of my book. But it seemed like he was always leading, trying to interrogate in a cross examination when he was questioning me about my story. He wanted to know more about killings and things like that. And I said, "You're not going to hear about killings from me." I said, "You're going to hear about gambling. You're going to hear about racketeering. You're going to hear about bribes. You're going to hear about payoffs. But you're not going to hear anything from me." I said, "I was a suspect, yes, at times. My father was. And there were many of us, close friends, were suspects when there was some kind of a killing in the neighborhood. But we would never convicted or prosecuted, even with the Elliot Ness deal my father was involved in. He was never convicted of that. But there was talk and hearsay through the Untouchable show, which was Elliot Ness, had stated that in his autobiography in 1957, he says it was Jimmy Napoli torpedo from Greenpoint, Brooklyn. All right, that's his opinion and whatnot, what happened there. Let's get back to my opinion now about Hoffa. Is if anything happened to him, even Tony Pro wouldn't be able to harm the man. He had a lot of favors to him, and he still had control of a lot of money. And look what happens later on. Hoffa is missing, and while he's still missing, his son runs for president and wins after Fitzgerald. So how bad could it be that Hoffa had a bad taste, or the boys had a bad taste for him, when his son is allowed to run while he's among the missing, and his son wins, and his son is doing the lousiest job of everybody, Hoffa Jr. He got raises for the executives, and he raised their dues, and actually is not accomplishing anything, and he's in there. So I would have to say, if a son could run while the father's missing, and there was, I don't think that any, listen to me carefully, that the boys had nothing to do with the disappearance of a Jimmy Hoffa. Unless he disappeared on his own, his son might know where he's at, and because of the fact that he had a parole going on, supervised probation. So in my opinion, can I say this, that you got the Pollock from Jersey City, the Iceman, then you got Sheehan, and there's another screwball. Everybody killed this guy. on their deathbed, they're saying this, and they're trying to get money for their family. And because they were away for murder, they were convicted. So they admit to other murders because of the name that's involved for a sensational story that their family could get some kind of royalties. I know Charlie Brandt collects the royalties for Sheehan's daughter. And that was the deal he made with Sheehan in the jailhouse for him to confess to the killing of Jimmy Hoffa so he could put it in that book of his called I Heard You Paint Houses. And by doing so, then he I don't know if he promised Sheehan, that is Charlie Brandt I'm talking about, the author of that book and the writer of that book, I Heard You Paint Houses, that he would take care of his daughter with royalty checks coming in, and he is. And he's a former prosecutor himself. So there are writers and authors that are trying to tell the people what they want to say and not what really happened. And those are those type of authors that shouldn't even be involved in writing the autobiography or being the writer for a man who's telling his story, because they pushed them into saying something that really didn't happen to make sensational news and a highlight of the story. The man's dying of cancer. He confesses he's in the jailhouse doing 50 years for two murders. He confesses, yeah, well, I killed him too. This way, he's told by the author, your family could get money. So why don't you think about this? You knew this guy. Tell the public what happened, what you did, you know? And they keep stressing that point, especially when an author's a former prosecutor.
There's no question.
I say that Jimmy Hoffa was never harmed, was never done away with by the boys, not even with Tony Giacone, who was the boss over there in Detroit, when they said that he was in the car in the back seat with the other guy driving when Hoffa came out of the restaurant, and that the FBI or the federal agents and the local police said that there was DNA showing that Hoffa was in that car. Sure, Hoffa was in that car previously. Hello. He was in that car previously. He knew the driver. The driver was his friend. What are you talking about? So anyway, my opinion is that if Hoffa, if he was done away with, it wasn't from the boys. No, definitely not. He was too well-liked. He moved a lot of money. He had a lot of money to him, and he didn't put pressure on for money. And he was coming in with more money even when he got out of jail.
So it wouldn't really have benefited the organized crime people to kill him.
Of course not, because they needed him for the money. Even he was still controlling money when he got out, and he still had money in the safe deposit box, and he still had a number someplace else in another bank account. But he was, follow that $1 million, where did it go? He withdrew $1 million. Nobody's talking about it. How come?
Very, very puzzling, and I understand certainly from an author's perspective, if you're willing to do what you think has been done, Jimmy Hoffa's name is going to move some books. I mean, there's no question if you claim, you know,
well,
that the first
he's
writing
moving
about
a lot
murder,
of books now, and
yeah.
He's got a lot of guys that are confessing to his murder. What if he shows up someday?
Okay, Tony.
What are those books still on a shelf?
We'll get back to that in a minute. We got another caller from the 718 area. Let me see who's on the line with us.
Don't worry about it. I'll be
area there. Code 718, you're on the line. Hello?
I'm still here.
You're still there, and we got another, but nobody's answering.
Probably somebody I know.
718, and then, yeah, well.
Maybe it's Jimmy Hoffa himself.
Jimmy called up to say these guys are all lying, right? So you think then, Tony, there's a possibility that he is in hiding, that he's still alive?
I don't think with old age that he still exists. I think that what I do know of individuals that died off in different states when they were released from jail or they had jumped bail that died off and their families have never been, and their families know where they're buried at, but the FBI doesn't. The FBI still thinks they're on a land, but they passed away.
Okay.
That could be the same situation. Yes, there are those that go on a lam or violate probation, don't want to go back, and they're pretty well up in age, and the family takes care of them. When they pass away, they bury them under another name in another state in the cemetery. Most of them are Catholic because they're Italian, you know.
Right.
Yes, a lot of that is being done, yes. There are a lot of men that died off that were never reported dead by families because of the FBI and the federal government would publicize and whatnot that they wanted to avoid all that, that they buried their loved one under an assumed name in a cemetery and let them rest in peace.
718, the caller shows is still being on the line. Let me try one. Are you there, caller? Nope. Okay. Well, I'm going to disconnect because apparently he's not with us. Tony, another thing that people have inquired about is when you changed your life around after the incident with the in which your daughter had been molested, you then wanted to write your story, and including a lot of information about your dad and you know, different activities and what you're doing now. And some people are interested in what did you have to do? Did you have to talk to your former associates and get permission? Did you have to, you know, how were you comfortable or were they comfortable with you writing your story?
All right. First of all, when I turned my life around after that unfortunate incident, what happened to my daughter, but it did cause me to find sobriety as I got sentenced to the VA hospital in Fort Hamilton for 3.5 years. Rather than go to a penitentiary, the judge, Joan O'Dwyer, sentenced me there for therapy because I took the law into my own hands and what I did to that punk that hurt my daughter. But he's alive today. However, that was 1.5 years after my father passed away. So my father was not alive. Now I'm on my own with the boys. Now, the satisfaction that was received by me was with the bosses helping me with send me a message that take the witness stand to defend your daughter. You defended your daughter's honor as long as you made a deal with the DA that you will not talk about your activities as far as employment goes. Just the situation, give a scenario of what happened in that college. And I made that deal with the DA and the judge, and sure enough, I was my only witness against 21 others who were students that actually saw what they saw, but became hostile witnesses because they all changed their story if they found out the probable cause of why I went in that classroom after that punk. However, after that, now I had a sentence for 3.5 years, and while I was at the VA hospital in Fort Hamilton, doing my time, I was able to come home on probation after 31 days and come back at night and go back every morning to the hospital for classes, for teaching and whatnot, and the training of the mind, and the therapy. It involved mental therapy for me to learn not to take the law into my own hands and what's wrong about it, the wrongs and the rights, and the yeses and the noes. And I was in group therapy. I refused to go one-on-one. I didn't want to go one-on-one to protect the counselor because in case they ever subpoenaed to go before a judge or a court of law. So I stayed in group therapy and enjoyed it very much so. And I learned from the patient therapist. Every patient is actually a therapist themselves. You know, they're called patient therapists in the circle I sat in, sometimes with 15, sometimes with 20 of us, sometimes with only six. I went to anger class as well, and I learned how to calm down. But my message to the boys and to, of course, the old-timers, I didn't want to bother with the young punks in the street. I didn't have to. And reminding them I never took the oath. I didn't break an oath. I didn't take the oath. My father made sure that I was not claimed by any one family, as even though I'm proclaimed by the federal government as a member of the Genovese family. So that's the way it's publicized. They talk about me as though they're talking about my father. And my father made sure of that, so my father said that you go through life, go in business, do what you want to do, and you didn't take the oath with the boys, so therefore they could never say you broke the oath and give them a reason to do away with you. And then again, why would they want to do away with me? If you read my book, you'll see everybody's gone, and I'm just bringing my message comes. Yes, that's true. It's about the mob life I was born into. However, but my message also brings across the sobriety part. If a person like me can find sobriety, anybody can. But you don't just find sobriety. The message is do something while you're in sobriety and stay in it by volunteer work. Help with bring the knowledge that you have from schooling or from your previous occupation. Bring that knowledge. Could be you were a lawyer, a professional man, an accountant, or a union rep, which I was. And also, I'm also an accountant. So when I went to school under the GI Bill and majored in accounting. So therefore, I would have to say that's the way to stay in sobriety, and that's the message, to do something, not to just stay home and fall asleep and do nothing after you get out of the mob life and after you find sobriety, but do something, be a volunteer to keep you going and help those that need you. It helps you to stay in sobriety too. Recovering alcoholics, ex-fighters who can't fight anymore. I volunteered to work for Ring 8, an organization called Ring 8, Veteran Boxing Association. We meet once a month. And we have funding coming in to help with the prescriptions and to pay for the doctors and sometimes rent money for fighters that can't fight anymore, disabled or retired with no money, and the veterans that I help, and of course recovering alcoholics. It sounds like I'm very busy. I'm not busy enough as far as I'm concerned. The same phone.
Tony, let me interrupt you a second. We show another caller on, and let's see if we have somebody on the line this time.
Okay, buddy.
Caller from 917, are you with us? Hello?
Hello?
Yes, 917 area code. You're on the air. Go ahead.
I'm just listening to the show.
Yeah. Well, you called in, though, so it looked like you would. Do you have a question or comment?
No question or comment. I'm just listening to the show.
Oh, okay, fine. I thought you were trying to get in to say something to Tony. Okay, you go back to listening then. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, so
yeah.
you went and wrote the book, and you've been, since what, 92? You've had a whole different life. And now you were a veteran. You were actually in the service yourself.
Yes, I was in the United States Air Force assigned to Strategic Air Command. I was also on the United States Air Force boxing team as well. And I flew all over the world with General Curtis LeMay as his personal security with 249 other airmen. And I learned guerrilla warfare, which is Strategic Air Command, known as SAC, S-A-C for short. is to locate the enemy, identify them, don't fire back if you're shot at, and get back as fast as you can. Get back to the base alive if you can to report on the maps where the enemy's at and where the prison camps are that had housed our prisoners, our people, our servicemen. And I had that training, which helped me besides in the ring, my boxing training, plus jiu-jitsu at the time. I had to have that as security for the president because of silent warfare, we call it. In other words, without making too much noise, to actually kill a guy, you know, if need be, in the middle of the night, with a wire or with your hands or a chokehold. And how to disarm someone with a bayonet or a knife, which helped me in that classroom with that punk, by the way. It came out of me, you know.
Yeah. Tony, so now, will you explain to us exactly what it is you do for the veterans? I know it has to do with helping them get benefits.
Yeah, and when a veteran needs help, he doesn't have any money to get a lawyer. So he comes to a volunteer like me because they talk about me, word of mouth. I'm a volunteer 15 years. July 11th will be 15 years in sobriety, as well as assisting veterans in the appeal process. What happens is when they get turned down, they come to me to appeal their case. And if they need an increase in their disability because their service-connected injury has gotten worse, I have the paperwork and I fill it out for them. And I send it to the right department of the government. And I help schedule with the doctors. The actual doctors at the VA hospitals and outside doctors, if they prefer to go there, if they're able to. And this way I get the diagnosis from outside doctors outside the VA hospital, as well as doctors in the VA hospital, to put together a platform to present to the Board of Veteran Appeals, which is five people. If one says yes, he's got the increase, or he wins the appeal. It has to be five to say no that the veteran loses. So therefore, if you're a man of odds and you understand it, it's in favor of the veteran. Only one out of five has to say yes. And those people on the board don't have to be former servicemen either. They could be business people or related to some politician or something. And I do the paperwork. And if they get turned down, I appeal it within a year so they don't lose a retroactive date. It's not unusual that I've gotten checks for veterans, $125,000 retroactive money. Of course, they waited 8 years and didn't give up and stayed with me to do it. And I don't take a dime. And they moved one. You met one personally out there in Vegas. I'd bought his bookstore at the airport, and the veteran was out there, and he was able to use that money as a down payment on a house in Vegas there, if you recall. And so the paperwork is not an easy task. And then after I complete the paperwork, because I do have my office in my home now, and I go to the VA hospitals to do paperwork for veterans, only if they can't get to me. And that's the process, the paperwork and sending it to the right department of the government. And it's mostly usually on in the appeal process when the veteran gets turned down. Now, what happens if a veteran wants to get an outside attorney, a civil lawyer? The civil lawyer cannot work with him because the government tells the civil lawyer how much he could charge that veteran. So that, in a way, I would have to say, is a process that should be changed. Because they don't want the lawyer to make a deal with like the 25% or the 30% of the retroactive money, that the government will tell that lawyer how much he's going to get. And, of course, the lawyer leaves the office at that time and tells the veteran to get somebody else, you know. Of course, it's peanuts compared to the type of paperwork that has to be done. So I'm not the only veteran that voluntarily does this. There are many like myself.
Let me ask you this, Tony. Do you think there are a lot of veterans out there that are entitled to benefits and just don't realize it?
A good percentage of them are out there. I don't know what figure to say, 10%, 20%, 30% or 40% or 50% of veterans that are out there that don't even know they're entitled to benefits because they had union jobs and they never used the VA facility because they had the hospitalization coverage with the union jobs. And as they get older, they retire, they got a good check coming in, Social Security and a union pension. So now I've had some of those type of veterans come to me that are retired, they're in their 70s, and they say now with the prescription problem, they need to go to the VA hospital. So therefore, those particular veterans are not looking for compensation for service-connected injuries. What they're looking for is compensation for prescriptions. And therefore, they would pay like $8 for a jar of 30 pills that would have probably cost them $40 or $50. So I'm able to do the paperwork for them to prove that they were in the service and did, at the time, did more than 6 months active duty, but today they want them at least doing 1 year active duty to be eligible to use the VA facilities, to use the doctors for that. So there's another category of veterans that percentage-wise that I say by word of mouth that they could use the VA facilities, but they will not. They're not eligible to get service-connected injuries because of the fact that they didn't get injured in the service. But they could still use the VA hospital. Those are the veterans that don't know about that. And it's not publicized enough.
Right.
Right. They don't have to put a claim in to use a VA hospital. They could use a VA hospital without putting a claim in just to see doctors if they did at least a year active duty.
Tony, let me just interrupt you for a second here. I've been monitoring our chat room, and we've got two or three things here. One, several of the people are congratulating you for your volunteer work, and that it's a great thing you're doing. Another person said that you should have a reality show, and it would be quite a show, and they all said they'd watch it. And another one was wondering about the time frame here. It says, I was going to ask Tony about how he got sent to Vegas. Was it after he got out of the Air Force? He went in the service, got out, and got his degree, and then was sent to Vegas. So, time-wise, Tony, when you first came here in 58, am I right, to Vegas?
1958, right, at the Sands Hotel.
And that was after you did the Air Force?
That's correct. I was already discharged from the United States Air Force, yeah, a few months, yeah.
Okay, but you had you gotten your degree yet or through the Veterans Benefits yet, or were...
A degree? I have no degree for that.
Okay.
I went. What happened was practical experience, and what happened was I was in Vegas, and then I left in '58, and then I had a hullabaloo in Vegas at the Sands Hotel. Not the Sinatra incident yet. That came back the second trip back there in the '60s, but when I came back, after meeting Jimmy the Weasel, Fratiano, who got me the job as a busboy, I believe I told you the last time, I could have gotten that job myself. I was going to UCLA, majoring in accounting under the GI Bill of Rights. That was my trip to California. And what happened was, during the summertime, I crossed the Mojave Desert, 325 miles, with a friend of mine to get the job at the Sands Hotel, and notified my father. And my father told me to go there in between schooling. So then there was a louse-up, and it's in my book, everything, but I don't want to, I don't know how not to procrastinate on it, so I'll cut it short. And my father got me back in New York, And, of course, he was upset that I went to school under the GI Bill. He wanted to pay my tuition. He thought it was like a welfare case. I told him, no, I earned that. I did my 2 years in the United States Air Force at the time before he got me honorably discharged, by the way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So now, but I went back to Vegas again in 1967, right. And, well, between 1966 and 67, I was back and forth at Caesar's Palace. Caesar's Palace was built in 65. We opened the doors, 64, 65 or so. And that was some of the funding from the Teamsters.
Teamsters. Tony, we got two more questions here in the chat room. One says you mentioned a couple minutes ago about a hullabaloo in Vegas. And the question is, what did you mean by hullabaloo?
Well, I was a drinking man, and I had a fight on the casino floor with one of the bosses from the Cleveland mob. I know, and a repeated situation years later at the Tropicana Hotel in Vegas. But my hullabaloos is drinking and fighting. And not taking orders. And that was the hullabaloo I'm talking about.
Okay. And second, somebody asked if Jimmy Hoffa had a nickname. Like Jimmy the Weasel was Fradiano. Did Hoffa have any nickname?
Yes, he did. Come to think of it, Hoffa had. They called him, oh my, I can't recall it now, but he did have a nickname, yes. There was a nickname. I can't recall it, though. But there was a nickname, and it wasn't used that often. But I can't recall his nickname at the present time. No. It wasn't anything that would denounce him or condone, you know. I forget what it was, though. I think it had something to do with his leadership, not his size. He was a very short individual, you know.
Yeah,
there was a nickname. Oh, you know, there was another individual involved here besides Tony Pro, you know. There was another guy who was accused of setting up a hit on Hoffa, was the name of Russell Buffalino from Pennsylvania area, who was a boss on the in the Pennsylvania wing of the Genovese family. And Buffalino, he died in jail himself. I think he was about 71. No, he might have been 71 or 83. I don't know, or something like that. But he died in jail, yeah. So did Tony Provenzano die in jail of a heart attack. Oh, Tony was, I think, 71. See, Tony, I knew. I used to have lunch with Tony in Jersey City when I had the Ragdoll, you know, in Union City, New Jersey.
Right.
So we would talk, and he would talk to my father and back and forth. And when I talk to people, I say, I don't get my information from an encyclopedia. I got it from practical experience, so take it for what it's worth yourself and accept it the way you want to accept it, because I'm talking about from old timers that nobody's around today, and I happen to outlive them because I was younger than them, that's all. But I didn't go in any encyclopedia or to any FBI Bureau of Investigators or any I actually lived it and sat down with them in restaurants, bars, social clubs, socializing in ballrooms like at Caesar's Palace and places like that, not just local taverns.
Now, Tony, we're running out of time again. We're down to a little over a minute. What I wanted to ask you was Hoffa personally violent? In other words, was he known as the kind of guy who would rough people up personally?
Well, there's an example. Look, he accused Tony Pro Provenzano of having a title in the Genovese family, mob life, right?
Mm-hmm.
In Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, in the jailhouse, when they were both co-defendants, they got sentenced there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course he had a temper because he attacked Tony Pro, knowing of his title. All right?
Yeah.
So he did have a, he had a, and listen, not only that, he tried to attack Bobby Kennedy in the courtroom. What are you talking about? Of course, it's obvious. Okay. He tried to attack him. I think I gotta find out again what his nickname was.
Yeah, if you do, pass it on to me, Tony, because I'll make sure the people who are interested.
Yeah,
know
so
about
you can
it.
Put it in one of your books too. Listen, last week some people called me personally later on or sent me email. They said that they wanted to know they wanted the chat room on this radio show or something. They said that they couldn't do a chat room or something. They were looking to do. Where's the chat room? Is one question.
I'll send you an email.
I can see it right here. It says play or chat. I got it on the website. Yeah.
Tony, they
a
just
lot of
cut
people.
Us off.
Huh?
They just cut us off. Our time ran out. So.
We're on an hour.
45 minutes we had.
How many? 45.
Yep, and it went by already. We just got cut off.
That was fast, yeah. So
listen,
what else?
If you learn that that name, is certainly I'll pass it on. And if you have any questions, you know, if your people or your friends don't see the chat room, they should see it like you just did when you got the chat option. And and Tony, I really appreciate you being back on with me.
Yeah. So in other words, my conclusion, in my opinion, that Hoffa was never really done away with, that he died of old age someplace. Because what happened with that $1 million he withdrew? There's a recording from that from a bank, the money he withdrew.
And nobody knows
shortly
where
before he was among the missing, you know?
Very interesting, very interesting.
Yeah, check on that yourself. You do good research, Danny, and I'll see what I can find out for you. But continue on with that to let the people know who are listening tonight about what his nickname was and about that $1 million.
I will do that, Tony.
Yeah,
I appreciate it because I'd never heard that before. So that's
there was $1 million withdrawal. Now, I don't know if it was one lump sum. I doubt it. It must have been piecemeal. Within 3 years, he withdrew $1 million. What did he do with the money? Because that 3 years is when he got released from jail in 71 and among the missing in 75, about 3.5 years interval here. What was he doing? He was living off that money. Where did he go? What did he do, you know?
Absolutely. Very interesting stuff. Tony, thanks a million. I'll be in touch.
All right. And give that woman my regards and give her my email.
I certainly will. Thanks a lot, Tony.
All right, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And tell Ira I still didn't get the demo.
I will.
All right. Tell Ira no tie.
Ira no tie. Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Tony.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Talk to you later. And thanks, everybody, for listening. And we'll catch you again on the next show. Bye-bye.